Wednesday and everything is normal except that nothing is normal. The birds from the makeshift aviary out the back of Susanna's house are in full voice. The roadworks on Nicholson Street, which must surely be almost finished, continue to moan and shudder and roar in the distance. The sun, unaware of how inappropriate a gesture this is, shines unembarrassed in the sky. It was, I am realising as I buckle up a seatbelt and referee a debate between the toddler and the six-year-old, exactly this time yesterday when we first saw the paramedics out the front of Alan's house. Alan, who was born in his front room 85 years ago and who died, unbelievably, yesterday. His death, despite his elderly vintage, has shocked us all, his neighbours, who know him only by an accident of geography, but who surely feel as I do this morning, confounded by his absence and his sad, empty house. But hang on, look, the house is not empty. A small trick of logic in my subconscious convinces me for a nanosecond that this is Alan now, edging out the door, carrying a cardboard box. It's not Alan, although it looks like him, and I remember that he has a brother, and I think a sister, who is perhaps the woman heading towards the house from the car, carrying a bucket and a mop, the head of which is still wearing a little cellophane sleeve from the shop. The cellophane glints in the sun, and the woman turns towards me. She's too young to be the sister. Susanna would know. Susanna, with all the animals from over the road, has known them all since she was a child. I must remember to text her, I think to myself. I smile at the woman with the mop, who might be Alan's sister, but she doesn't see and continues to gently explore the private space of a man who was once a boy on this very street, being hurried along by his own mother, the sun confidently oblivious and the birds filling the morning with noise.
My head is swimming after my late-night drinking session with the neighbours. You wouldn't recognise me lately. I barely recognise myself. It was the noise of the children that brought me here, to the window.
No, not you, Molly.
Would you please just get in the car? Legs in, hands in, please.
But now their car pulls away down the street and I can see Phil over at Alan's place, organising things with someone. His daughter, I suspect. And I'm not shocked at his age. Haven't seen him for how many years? Front bar of the commercial it was, I think, the last time. I didn't drink, of course, but he did. And you did. Now, it's not age that surprises me, but death, for some reason, always does. In the early days after you died, that therapist with the cold hands used to talk about what she called
the grieving process.
An expression that made everything ahead of me seem dumb, stumbly and inevitable, like I was a fool, learning like a baby foal how to take wobbly steps into a world I could not yet understand. When I told her, this therapist, about the police officer handing me your bag, she called it
a moment of trauma.
That made me laugh. I still refer to that when I run out of milk or I can't open a jar. Moment of trauma. But really, grief just feels like a loud new fact. Still echoing from the moment you heard it.
It's your brother. They found him. It's not good news.
When Costa comes with the mail, he raps on the door as usual and a letter from the council flutters through the slot. I don't even see the next bit coming. Constantly prepared for catastrophe, but not for this. I read the letter 3 times. Notice of breach of council building regulation. The bloody aviary. They're going to make me tear down the aviary. I know this means someone reported it. I've known about it for ages. My hands are shaking when I hit play. Rachmaninoff, taking no prisoners. I lean against the wall and I don't think of you at all. And I breathe.
The toddler and I are heading out to get some milk when I realise there's noise coming from Susanna's house. Music. Piano, loud and fast. I get my phone out to text her to see how she is after we stood together in the street with Gail last night, drinking whiskey and toasting Alan, as though that was a perfectly standard thing for the three of us to do. But then I am distracted by Alan's brother lugging stuff from the house to the car. Clothes, a suit in a dry cleaning bag. I briefly consider approaching, but lose my nerve. Anyway, the toddler needs rescuing. He's found a tiny plastic Power Ranger on a wonky bedside table discarded out the front of the flats. He has no idea what a Power Ranger is, and neither do I, if I'm entirely honest, but he flies it through the air like a rocket and... This way, I say, as he doubles back towards our place, the rocket reversing our already painfully slow egress and... Oh, look at that, he's teetered sideways into a rubbish bin and let me just submit to the meeting that popping out to get milk just ain't what it used to be. Finally, the toddler on my shoulders, we walk to the track works on Nicholson Street. They're laying asphalt, the steam rising off it, while they rake it flat with those upside-down rakes. Even I'm into this bit. But when I look down, the toddler is heading toward the cafe behind me and...
Hi there.
I turn around. It's Kylie Smiley Shoe, the construction worker with a smiley face on her shoe. The one I have decided I love, despite speaking only a few words to her. She's with the white-haired guy she works with. He nods at me formally. She reaches the door of the cafe and holds it open for the toddler who has left me now, for Kylie with the smiley shoe. I obediently follow, the toddler not quite believing his luck. And I guess now we are going to the cafe.
And that's bloody Kylie for you. Knows bloody everyone. Except she doesn't. Who's that? I ask her.
That?
She says. Yes, I say. The woman and her kid are settling at a nearby table. Kylie looks at me.
No idea.
She says, with one of those smiles you have to double-check for. The others come in now. Woman behind the counter looks panicked, and why not? The buggers just keep coming. It's a wonder there's anyone left on site. Kylie moves the sugar on our little table aside as if to clear the decks.
Listen.
She says, and I think, hang about, what's this then?
How did you go with the Amir question?
There are several seconds where I'm flailing for some form of context here. But then the young lad Amir comes to mind.
It's just... I'm pretty worried about him and he's not talking to me.
Yeah, I say to her. I imagine that'd be killing you. She smiles. But not really. I tell her I'd be much obliged if she'd point to the clause in my contract that compels me to launch a royal bloody commission into whether or not some bloke needs a cuddle... But she keeps looking at me.
So you'll talk to him?
She says, and she's turning towards the others, inviting them to join. They're all smiles and backslaps. Delighted to see her. And of course I'll bloody talk to him. Bloody Kylie, honestly.
The woman behind the counter is in full panic mode now. And she slips me a coffee in such a hurry that it jumps in its own puddle on the saucer. A bunch of them have left now, and it's just Kylie and half a dozen others at the table near us. The white-haired guy is long gone. One of the younger blokes flips his phone around and shows it to Kylie.
He all right, you reckon?
Kylie reaches out and holds his hand with the phone in it in her own. Squints at the screen. Another bloke leans over,
Talking about Amir?
Yeah, mate. You worked with him before? He always liked this?
A little bit. Always kept to himself, not this bad.
Bloke can barely look me in the eye.
Kylie lets go of the phone and starts standing up to leave.
Damo's on it.
There's a pause while they look up at her. Some of them go back to eating.
Damo's all right, eh?
One of them says.
Just from my dealings.
Kylie gathers her keys and her hard hat.
The thing about Damo,
she says. They watch her, their food suspended mid-bite.
Is that he makes an incredible vindaloo.
The men at the table take this in.
Shut up,
says one of them. She's grinning at them.
No shit,
she says.
Used to work in hospo 100 years ago.
Yeah? Fucking hell. Keep quiet about that one.
Keeps quiet about a lot of things,
she says. And she has not told them what they want to know, but she has given them something they are happy to have. She turns from them and salutes the woman behind the counter. When she opens the door, an elegant diamond ring on her finger catches in the sun and she gives the toddler a little wave. Damo, I think to myself, must be the boss. The guy with the white hair must be Damo. We're leaving too now, getting everything organised. The construction blokes are flicking absently through their phones.
Made a seriously good risotto last night,
one of them says. And I'm going to miss these guys when the track works are finished. When we arrive home, the total time of our quick trip out to buy milk is 1 hour and 55 glorious minutes. It's after dark when I make it out again, lugging a rubbish bag out to the bin. The car out the front of Alan's is gone. I think of his family. How sad it must be, sifting through his things together, preparing for whatever comes next.
G'day,
says Greg, closing his front door, reversing out into the world, his ancient dog beside him. We talk for a bit about Alan's memorial, which is apparently on Saturday at the Italian Cultural Centre in Carlton. I ask, stupidly, if Alan is Italian.
No,
says Greg.
His brother's just big in the union. Knows a lot of these guys. Good bloke, by all accounts.
Greg really does seem to know everything. So I ask him about Alistair, who's moved into the new apartment over the road.
One of those developer turkeys,
he says.
Made his money knocking down housing commission flats and putting up shoebox apartments. Dressed up as a community initiative. People living in harmony from all walks of life kind of thing. Riding bikes to work. That bit meant they didn't need to provide parking.
He looks over at Alistair's apartment.
Our bloke's run into a bit of trouble since then, though. He did something in Brunswick that, by all accounts, hasn't gone down well. And now this little joint, empty for months, and now he's living there.
We look at the deserted apartment next to Alistair's. Its brightly coloured door seems inappropriately boastful.
Met the sister the other day,
says Greg, who is now yanking his ancient dog off down the street.
She's the story.
And as he leaves, I'm thinking what a great compliment that is. She's the story. Next to Alistair's, the windows in Susanna's house are dark, which doesn't mean anything because the windows in Susanna's house are always dark. And it's too late to text her now, but as I head back to our place, even compared to Alan and Greg and Gail and Frankie from 100, I think Susanna's the story.